nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
The next piece of the program is a series of presentations on our best practices collective effort. And I have to tell you, as an editorial comment, it's something I really like about LioHub, in the sense that people get together and actually do useful things. And I really feel that the best practice effort is a good example of people from different companies getting together and doing useful things. There are three presentations here. I'm going to start off with best practices for process instrumentation. Arnab's going to talk about equipment performance qualification. Sumit Luthra about a scale-up and tech transfer. And Feroz Jamil is talking about modeling lyophilization and validation packages. So let's start with the best practices for process instrumentation. It's the one that's farthest along. It was published more than a year ago. I think it was early 2017. This is just a list of all the people that contributed to this, and we're liberal about co-authorship. You know, anybody who participated at all was included as a co-author. I think it's important to do that. But the whole idea behind this best practices effort is that there are areas we know we have to respect each other's intellectual property around APIs and around the specifics of formulation. But there are a lot of areas of freeze-dry science and technology where everybody benefits by putting their heads together and coming up with a collective opinion about what constitutes best practice. And I should tell you, it's not an attempt to lay down the law at all. It's just to give people some means of focusing and collecting their thoughts and determining, you know, what's their view of best practice. And there are plenty of areas. I've just jotted down a few of them here. Things like scientific justification for acceptance criteria for leak rate in freeze dryers. That's an area where there seems to be a lot of differences in opinion. People spend a lot of time talking about it. Acceptance criteria for visual appearance of freeze-dried solids. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. Equipment qualification, cleaning validation, scientific justification for sampling plans, particularly for residual moisture, scale-up, process validation. And these are only a few areas where we can benefit by collaborating instead of competing. And another sort of a why to this is that there's a lot of uncertainty over best practices in a lot of areas, and that uncertainty can cause unnecessarily delays, overly conservative decision making, particularly when the decision makers only may have a superficial understanding of technical aspects of the process. There's often not enough reflective thought behind the science and engineering behind many operational aspects of freeze drying. And I've done my own sort of non-scientific studies where I've called up colleagues in the industry, acceptance criteria for a leak rate. And you ask them, you know, what their justification is, what their criteria are. And you get a lot of comments like, well, gee, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. We've done it that way for as long as I've been in this job. But my conversations have sort of led me to the conclusion that people don't think about it as much as they really should. And really, who wants to be caught unprepared during technical discussions with regulatory agencies? Not me, certainly. So the broad objectives of the effort, I said there's no intent to lay down the law. But we want to highlight points to consider. We want to stimulate discussion of best practices as much as we can, encourage reflective thought, and as well as identify ideas where applied research may be needed. In the workshop yesterday afternoon, Liz was talking about model-based regulatory filings, and she was asking the question of the group, you know, what do we need to be working on here? It's a good question, and it's a question that deserves a good answer. And I think that There are many cases where we can identify areas where our academic colleagues may be able to weigh in answering questions that we don't necessarily know the answer to. So I'm going to talk a little more specifically now about best practice for process instrumentation. And we limited this to instruments and techniques that are applicable at both laboratory and production scale. We've sort of eliminated single vial-based methods. We're interested in things that are more broadly applicable, both lab and manufacturing scale. We titled this paper Best Practice 2017 to emphasize the idea that this is really a working document and an ongoing effort, because best practices could and really should change as technology improves. And I'm hoping that the next edition of Best Practices for Process Instrumentation will look significantly different than the one that was published just recently. So we included best practice applied to currently existing technology, but we thought it would be a good idea to also include developing technology. We're very interested, and I hope the next version of best practice for process instrumentation, the instrument of choice, is some kind of a wireless temperature measurement system, simply because of all of the logistical problems of trying to measure product temperature, particularly at a production freeze dryer, when you've got these long leads to deal with that only cause complication and uncertainty. TDLAS, not at laboratory scale, we're mostly, I said a little bit earlier that we consider production scale a TDLAS still developing technology that we want to see moved forward continuously. Mass spec as a process analytical method, as well as heat flux measurement, which is actually sort of the basis of the Milrock approach to process analytical technology. So I've talked a little bit about product temperature measurement already and how it's necessary for cycle development and how practices differ widely across the industry with respect to product temperature measurement in a manufacturing setting. And here are areas where it's useful: scale-up, cycle validation, clinical batches, engineering batches, transfer of cycles between manufacturing sites, as well as routine monitoring of production batches. All of those areas where product temperature information can be useful. This is a snapshot of what I would consider a typical product thermocouple in a manufacturing setting. There are several things wrong with this picture. The thermocouples are too coarse. They're too thick. They get really stiff at low temperature, and they move around when you're trying to locate them. And when they move around, as often as not, they'll be knocking vials over. There's no mechanism for securing the thermocouple in a specific location in the vial. The specific location ought to be in the middle of the vial, touching the bottom. So the nature of this instrumentation just leads to a whole lot of uncertainty, lack of data integrity. We think it ought to look more like this. One, we're using fine gauge thermocouple wire. We use this holder that fits in the inside finish of the vial to secure it in place. There's a stainless steel guide tube. You can thread the thermocouple through that tube. It fits loosely enough. You can slide it back and forth, but it's tight enough. It doesn't move on its own. There are holes in the top of the holder that are about the same size as the opening and in the slots in a partially stoppered vial. So the resistance of the device is about the same as a partially stoppered vial. And we can think this constitutes best practice in a laboratory setting, and there's no reason why it couldn't constitute best practice in a production setting. It's just that you don't very often see this. So we submit that best practice is to use a fine gauge thermocouple wire along with some kind of a device to hold the thermocouple in a fixed position, tip of the thermocouple in the center of the vial and touching the bottom. Okay, the open area of the device should approximately equal the opening of a partially stoppered vial. We have to be aware of the sources of uncertainty in product temperature measurement in a production environment, and don't overinterpret such data. And it's not that manufacturing folks don't do a really good job, don't try their best when they're asked to put thermocouples in vials, but unlike a laboratory freeze dryer that's got a plexiglass door and you can look in there and you can see that, or you can verify that your thermocouple vials aren't partially tipped up on their edge. In a production environment, you have a very limited view. Even if you have sight glasses on the freeze dryer, you can only see so far into the array. So you don't really know that the thermocoupled vials are positioned properly and sitting flat in full contact with the shelf, at least as best they can be. This is an example of a different kind of product temperature measuring element. This is an RTD, a resistance temperature detector. It's fundamentally different from a thermocouple. In many ways, RTDs are better than thermocouples in terms of stability, linearity, all of the quality attributes. Generally, an RTD-type device beats a thermocouple. What's different, though, is that a thermocouple is a point measurement. You measure the temperature at the point where the two wires of the thermocouple are joined together. Okay? An RTD, in contrast, is an area measurement. You get an average value over the exposed area of this element. And the source of uncertainty here is, picture, this is an empty vial, but picture a depth of fill that, it might correspond pretty closely to the height of the RTD. Well, you're not very far into primary drying where your RTD is partially immersed in frozen material and partly in the dried layer. So you're going to get a reading that's the average of the two, and it's going to be biased on the high side because the area that's not in contact, that the dried layer is going to be warmer than the frozen matrix. Now, I don't know whether you've used an instrument called an ELAB, these process monitoring devices. These are thermocouples. I'm sorry. These are resistance temperature detectors. They are RTDs. They're much smaller than the one I just showed you. And the point I'm trying to make is the smaller the RTD, the more it's going to approach a point measurement, as you would get from a thermocouple. This is a device where you still have to worry about getting it located precisely and some mechanism to hold it there. You still have a bit of a lead to deal with. You have to be concerned about what are you going to do with this capsule during a freeze-dry process. But people do use this, and they can manage that okay. And basically, at the end of the process, you take this, I don't know the right name for it. I'm calling it a capsule for now. You take it to a reader station, and you dump the process data. But again, the point I'm trying to show you is the small size of the RTD. And the smaller, the better, in my opinion. Regarding pressure measurement, the capacitance manometer is the instrument of choice for pressure measurement and control and freeze drying. I don't think anybody disputes that. They're stable. They're linear over a wide pressure range, at least four decades. Much broader than any kind of a thermal conductivity type gauge. And they also give you they measure true pressure, force per unit area, independent of the composition of the vapor phase in the process of interest. We submit then that the best approach with respect to pressure measuring instrumentation is to have both a capacitance manometer and a Pirani gauge on both the chamber shown here and the condenser shown here. I'm always surprised by the number of times you'll see people spend a couple million dollars for a production freeze dryer, and then they decide to economize on process instrumentation. I think it was Alina that said, geez, I've got at least four pressure. I've got a pressure gauge in every tire of my $35,000 car. But yet people buy a freeze dryer and they only put one pressure gauge on it. That doesn't make any sense. And I agree. It doesn't make any sense. So again, why do you want to put both a Pirani gauge and a capacitance manometer on the chamber? Because it allows this technique I've already mentioned called comparative pressure measurements. It's been around for a long time, but the industry has been slow to adapt it. And I don't understand why not, because in our hands anyway, it's inexpensive, it's sensitive, it's robust, it's giving you a window into the process that you don't get by putting any kind of a sensor in individual vials of product. And again, we've talked about this earlier, but the magenta line is the apparent pressure. We don't care what the real pressure is. The real pressure is right here, the capacitance manometer. We're controlling it, 75 millitorr. We care about the apparent pressure. So we're not so worried about calibration of the Pirani gauge. This shows us when we're in primary drying, the higher apparent pressure arises from the fact that the composition of the vapor phase is almost all water vapor, and it has a higher conductance than nitrogen does, hence the higher apparent pressure. At this point, primary drying is over. The apparent pressure drops off rapidly, and the steepness of the drop is a measure of the vial-to-vial consistency in drying rate. So there's useful information in this part as well. Now we're approaching the end of primary drying. In our freeze dryers, we have the option of sequencing the cycle based on the difference in pressure reading between the Pirani gauge and the capacitance manometer so that we can sequence the cycle, run an automatic cycle where the transition from primary to secondary drying is based on that pressure difference. Works very well for us. It's a handy tool. At this point, primary drying is over. We increase the shelf temperature to the secondary drying condition. Ice is not there. We see another increase in apparent pressure as we drive off the unfrozen water. It quickly goes up, then tails back down. And at this point, we're done with the process. So we've gotten it there again. It's a very, in our hands, robust way to find out, to get a window into your process. One item of caution is if vials falling off a shelf is an issue and you have a few vials laying in the bottom of the freeze dryer, that can be enough to fool the Pirani gauge into giving you a funny sort of reading, different than what you would get here, because it doesn't take very many vials drying at a non-representative rate to kind of throw this off. But with that as sort of a word of caution, it's a relatively foolproof method. So in order to do that, you need a capacitance manometer and a Pirani gauge on the chamber. We think you need a capacitance manometer on both the chamber and the condenser. The reason for that is that the difference in pressure between the chamber and the condenser can be a useful indicator of equipment performance, particularly around choked flow. The literature says for a cylindrical tube that a pressure ratio between chamber and condenser of 3:1 is taken to be confirmatory of choked flow in that system. Now, the picture is more complicated than that because it assumes a clean tube, and oftentimes our tube is not as clean as we would like it. For one thing, you've got a valve there that's going to change things a bit. But the point is that pressure ratio we found can be a useful indicator of what the equipment is doing and whether you might be approaching the limit of the capability of that freeze dryer. So that's about why capacitance manometer on both chamber and condenser. Then the last piece is, why do you put a Pirani gauge on the condenser? We think Pirani gauges aren't very expensive, and it can be really useful as a troubleshooting tool if you're trying to find the source of a vacuum leak. In our development lab environment, we typically use LioStar freeze dryers. There's a door on the condenser and a door on the chamber, and a lot of times you'll turn on the vacuum pump and the pressure won't come down. It's useful in finding, okay, where's the leak coming from? If you can isolate chamber from condenser and measure them using a Pirani gauge, you can troubleshoot those leaks much more quickly. The idea is that a Pirani gauge will start reading as soon as the pressure gets just below atmospheric pressure. A capacitance manometer won't start reading until you get below the upper limit of that gauge. In pharmaceutical freeze drying, that upper limit, depending on the gauge choice, is either 1 torr or 10 torr, but you've got a long way to go before you actually get a reading. So it's not very useful as a troubleshooting tool, whereas a Pirani gauge is. The Pirani gauge signal may not be very accurate at just below atmospheric pressure, but you don't really care since you're just troubleshooting anyway. Well worth the money to have the extra gauge just to minimize time in troubleshooting vacuum leaks. We need to remember, we do manufacture some products that use organic solvents, tertiary butanol in particular. We have to keep in mind that Pirani gauge uses a hot filament. So we need to be cautious about formulations that contain that organic solvent. There seem to be two ways to do it. Turn off the Pirani gauge if you're manufacturing a product that uses an organic solvent. Our colleagues in Halle also flush the system. Instead of turning it off, they just flush the system with nitrogen before they ever start the freezing process. You know, in order to have a hazard of an explosion, you have to have a high enough concentration of solvent to ignite and enough oxygen to support combustion. Now, during the primary drying phase of a freeze-dry cycle, neither of those criteria are met. The most dangerous point is actually when you first start to pull a vacuum in the system. That's when you have the highest potential for the organic solvent vapor igniting. But as I said, both approaches seem to work fine. There's also a point of view that Pirani gauges can't be sterilized. That's just not true. Although it may well be true that different Pirani gauges, in particular different filaments, have different robustness to steam sterilization. In the paper, we talk about a particular filament that's been tested 50, 60 sterilization cycles, and it's been fine throughout. Where there are other filaments that have been tested, and after one or two cycles, the filament seems to be shot. So there is some truth to that, but the lesson is you have to be careful about the Pirani gauge that you choose. I think I'm going to stop there because we're already a little bit behind.